This is Free Speech Radio News for Wednesday, March 19, 2008. From Pacifica Station KPFK in LA, I'm Aura Bogado. People around the country mark the fifth anniversary of the start of the Iraq War. We'll hear from direct actions and police repression in San Francisco.
They're grabbing some protesters. They're beating one with a club.
As well as demonstrations against 5 years of war in Washington, D.C. and New York City. All that and more, but first, the headlines.
I'm Shannon Young with the headlines. As China continues to crack down on pro-independence demonstrators in Tibet, European activists are calling on EU leaders to boycott the Olympic Games to be held in Beijing later this year. Cinnamon Nippard has more from Berlin.
The president of the European Parliament has suggested that EU political leaders should consider boycotting the Olympics opening ceremony if the Chinese crackdown continues. And the Italian government has called on the EU to send a team to discuss the situation with China. However, Amnesty International and Human Rights Watch have criticised the EU's inaction, saying China must be held accountable for the violence and must adhere to the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights and the UN Convention Against Torture. Amnesty is calling for the EU to support its demands for China to allow the United Nations to conduct an independent investigation into allegations of human rights abuses. Since the 12th of March, Chinese authorities have refused to allow foreign journalists into Tibet, and at least 25 journalists have been ejected from Tibet or Tibetan areas. Cinnamon Nippard reporting for Free Speech Radio News in Berlin.
A British judge has annulled a court order that froze $12 billion of assets belonging to the Venezuelan state energy company, PDVSA. The frozen funds were the result of a lawsuit brought by ExxonMobil, in which the oil giant claimed that Venezuela had acted unjustifiably in the process of nationalizing its oil fields. The Venezuelan assets had been frozen as possible compensation for ExxonMobil ahead of pending international arbitration. A new report released by the Inspector General of the Department of Justice concludes that the government has for 3 years received inaccurate and incomplete information for the nation's terrorism watch list. Africa Jones reports.
The report found that failures by the FBI allowed the names of innocent people to remain on the watch list and the names of those who potentially posed a real threat to be left off. The National Counterterrorism Center uses reports released by the FBI to compile the watch list, but the DOJ's Inspector General found the FBI did not provide regular updates to remove or add names. The Inspector General also says a large number of names were added to the list without proper vetting. For years, privacy advocates have complained that the terrorism watch list contains too many errors and is poorly managed. The FBI says some of the problems with the system have been fixed and that the agency is working to integrate the Inspector General's recommendations. The American Civil Liberties Union estimates that the terror watch list currently contains over 900,000 names. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Africa Jones.
Representatives of the University of Texas at Brownsville and the Texas Southernmost College are in court today for a hearing on a federal lawsuit to force the schools to grant access to their property in preparation for the construction of a border fence. It's the second round of hearings this week before U.S. District Judge Andrew Hanen. 28 related cases were heard on Monday. Defendants in the lawsuit include large and small individual property owners, schools, water districts, and local governments.
It does cut across a pretty big section of landowners, and all of them have basically been treated the same way with regard to negotiation and contact by the government prior to suit.
Celestino Gallegos is a staff attorney with Texas Rio Grande Legal Aid. He represents small landowners in the McAllen area. Gallegos says the judge wants to see evidence of an effort on the part of the government to negotiate access. Although an offer has been made in some cases, many landowners aren't satisfied.
In this case, what the government offered was $100. They said that their right to access your property for 6 months or a year with pretty much free range to do all these other sort of things in the context of investigatory work and surveys, that's worth $100.
If the judge later rules that the $100 offer constitutes negotiation, landowners who continue to refuse access may have their property condemned and seized by the federal government. And finally, visionary science fiction writer Arthur C. Clarke died this morning in a private hospital in the Sri Lankan capital, Colombo, after he was admitted for respiratory problems. He was 90 years old. Arthur C. Clarke wrote more than 100 books on space, science, and the future over the course of his long and critically acclaimed career. His most famous work is 2001: A Space Odyssey. Clarke was credited with the concept of communication satellites in 1945, decades before they became a reality. He moved to Sri Lanka in 1956. His adopted homeland has honored him with three of its most esteemed awards. Clarke is to be buried in Colombo on Saturday. Those are the headlines. I'm Shannon Young.
Today marks the fifth anniversary of the start of the Iraq War. President Bush defended the decision to go to Iraq and the ongoing occupation today, saying that his resolve is just as strong as it was in 2003.
5 years ago tonight, I promised the American people that in this struggle ahead, we will accept no outcome but victory. Today, standing before men and women who have helped liberate a nation, I reaffirm the commitment.
Bush conceded that the war has brought a high cost in terms of lives and money, but insists that critics can no longer, quote, credibly argue that we're losing in Iraq, unquote. But the numbers may tell a different story. The surge has increased troop levels past 160,000 service persons serving in Iraq as daily violence continues. An unknown number of Iraqis have lost their lives, up to 1.2 million men, women, and children. Unemployment plagues between 25% to 50% of the workforce, and those Iraqis that haven't lost their lives or fled as refugees are forced to survive with little or no clean water and improper sanitation, coupled with deficient health care, likely a result of poorly managed private contracts. The International Committee of the Red Cross says that the humanitarian crisis in Iraq is, quote, the most critical in the world. Meanwhile, back in the United States, people are holding vigils for the nearly 4,000 U.S. troops killed in the war, as well as demonstrations and direct actions in an attempt to bring a halt to the war and to bring the troops back home. Our Brian Edwards-Tiekert is in downtown San Francisco, where there are scattered direct actions shutting down various government and corporate offices. Brian, can you give us an idea of what's happening there right now?
Out on at the intersection of 3rd Street and Market Street in downtown San Francisco, where there's an unpermitted demonstration blocking a major intersection in the commercial district with a dying. I'm here with Rahula Janowski of the Heads Up Collective, one of dozens of affinity groups that have organized decentralized, nonviolent direct actions across the city today in protest of the U.S. occupation of Iraq on the fifth anniversary of the U.S. invasion. Rahula, tell me, what exactly is the point of the action you planned here today? Why are you all lying down in the middle of the street?
Well, we're holding an intersection at 3rd and Market. After having marched through the entire financial district with a really high-energy, high-spirited march, putting out a lot of messages about San Francisco is opposed to the war. We want the war to end. 5 years is too long for this. And we're holding this intersection because it's time for the anti-war movement to step it up. It's time for the anti-war movement to take it beyond being a majority anti-war country to a country that is not only majority anti-war, but where the majority of people are acting on that and taking action, organizing to build a movement that's going to bring the war to an end. So this holding this intersection is one of the ways that we are stepping it up. And other folks were doing stuff downtown today that also were stepping it up and spreading the message wider that it's time for the anti-war movement to activate.
I should mention that as we speak, the police have issued a dispersal notice and they're massing on the street next to us. Are you planning to be arrested today?
I just assume not, but if it happens, it happens. Personally, I'd like to just hold the intersection all day. All kinds of human needs are suffering for this war, and so we have to step it up.
Whoa, the police are moving in and breaking up the crowd now. They're grabbing some protesters. They're beating one with a club. They're shoving other protesters away from them and out of the street. They're circle around the people who are lying down in the middle of the street. They've one person who is not participating in the direct action to the ground. It's not clear what they think she did. They've got her hands behind their back and they're handcuffing her. Earlier actions today blockaded the offices of Chevron downtown San Francisco, which apparently told its employees not to come in today. They also targeted the Federal Reserve, and they targeted the meeting of the University of California Regents, where students were protesting that university's weapons research contract. Other actions are planned throughout the day. There is planned to be some kind of direct action at Senator Dianne Feinstein's office. The action is highly decentralized. They're planned by small affinity groups, and then supporters are mobilized by SMX direct messages as a flash mob.
That's Brian Edwards-Tiekert reporting from San Francisco. Meanwhile, protesters in Washington, D.C. connected the war to oil. They focused on the American Petroleum Institute, which, according to its website, represents all aspects of the oil and gas industry. FSRN's Leanne Caldwell reports.
No warming! Resistance is forming!
The day started early for these protesters. In the height of rush hour traffic, bicyclists blocked a busy intersection in downtown Washington, D.C. Police intervened, officers on foot dragged them out of the street. Nearly 200 protesters rallied outside the American Petroleum Institute, the nation's largest lobbying firm for the oil and gas industry. Their board of directors is packed with big oil executives. But police were prepared and had already blockaded the building's entrance to dissuade attempts by protesters to get into the building. Protesters convinced that the Iraq war and continued occupation is for oil say it's detrimental to the environment, the economy, and humanity. Antonia Yuhas is with Oil Change International.
Chevron, Exxon, Marathon, and Conoco are already marketing Iraqi oil, but what they want, in the words of ExxonMobil, are 30-year contracts for ownership of oil under the ground. We think if this war is going to end, Exxon's going to have to be denied those 30-year contracts, and we're going to have to remove the oil agenda from the war to end the war immediately.
Oil Change International compiled an internet database that connects contributions to big oil with war votes in Congress. They also took a look at oil money the presidential candidates receive. Steve Kretzmann is executive director.
The Democrats, Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama, don't take corporate campaign contributions from the oil industry, but they do take donations directly from top executives of the oil industry. And most interestingly, of the three, Clinton, McCain, and Obama, Senator Clinton is now in the lead, taking over $267,000 in oil industry donations for her presidential campaign. Senator McCain is second with $229,000, and Senator Obama is third with $128,000. So it's an interesting spread. It shows that the oil industry is spreading its bets a little bit, and not betting heavily on one side or the other.
With Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama raising $70 million more dollars than Senator McCain, the percentage of oil money he receives is much higher. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Leanne Caldwell.
Demonstrators from throughout the country also protested in front of the Internal Revenue Service in Washington, D.C. today. FSRN's Tanya Snyder has more.
We support war resistors. They're our brothers. They're our sisters.
Hundreds, like Frida Berrigan of the War Resisters League, gathered in Washington, D.C. to protest the fifth anniversary of a war they say has already cost too many lives and too much money.
I'm here because on the fifth anniversary of the war that has cost so far $800 billion, $3.5 billion a week. We also look at the deaths. Almost 4,000 American soldiers have been killed, and that doesn't include private military contractors who have been killed. And then there's hundreds of thousands of Iraqis. By one study, a million Iraqis have been killed in this war.
Demonstrators at this spirited protest in front of the IRS building oppose the use of American tax dollars for war. Bob Levitt from California was among them.
I'm here as yet another ashamed taxpayer trying to make some amends for having dropped to my knees and capitulated and paid my taxes again last year. And I live with that shame in a very real and painful way, given the suffering that those dollars cause.
Other protests, sponsored by Code Pink, the War Resisters League, Oil Change International, Peace Action, and other anti-war groups, broke out around Washington today. No War, No Warming organized a self-guided Monopoly game with stops at the offices of companies they say profit off the war, like Bechtel, Halliburton, the American Petroleum Institute, ExxonMobil, and DynCorp. One person was arrested for more than a dozen street blockades that took place, and 34 were arrested for crossing police barricades in front of the IRS, including 18-year-old Sarah Mahollis, who said this as she was taken, handcuffed, into a police paddy wagon.
I'm trying to stop a crime against humanity because the IRS is using my money to commit crimes against humanity.
Protests continued throughout the day with a dance party in the park called Funk the War, a bicycle critical mass focused on kicking the U.S. oil addiction, and a granny brigade knitting stump socks for soldiers with amputated limbs. For FSRN, I'm Tanya Snyder.
Peace activists are rallying and protesting all over New York City today. And although most of the gathering will be after work, two groups convened at the Times Square recruiting station despite pouring rain. FSRN's Rebecca Miles was there and files this report.
As the Congress exercised its war powers under Article 1, Section 8?
No!
That's better, grannies. No, they did not.
It's an illegal war.
Why today? Absolutely. It's unconstitutional.
Norman Siegel, the civil liberties lawyer with the Granny Peace Brigade outside the Times Square recruiting station in New York City today. Siegel was referring to the U.S. Constitution that says the only entity that can declare war on another nation is the Congress.
It's 5 years later to the day, and almost 4,000 Americans have died in this war. 175 New York State residents have died in this war. Over 80,000 Iraqi civilians have died. Almost 30,000 Americans have been wounded. And of that 30,000, approximately 1,400 are New York State residents. It's already cost us over $600 billion, with projections into the trillions.
Sybil Pearson is one of the Granny Peace Brigade and explained why she stopped to join the protest on the way to work.
Living with myself, really. I mean, it's not for any other reason. I don't think I could have gone through today without being at some kind of a protest about this war.
And living with yourself is probably what encouraged so many women out in the rain. 2 years ago, the Granny Peace Brigade was arrested and prosecuted for protesting the war outside the recruiting station at Times Square. This year, a group of five people holding American flags were allowed to support the war standing outside the station. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Rebecca Miles, reporting from New York.
According to international law, rules of engagement set legal and ethical standards for the use of force. But as the Iraq War marks its fifth anniversary today, soldiers like Steve Mortillo, who served in the U.S. Army between November 2002 to November 2005 and deployed to Iraq with the 1st Squadron Cavalry, 1st Infantry Division, soldiers don't have time to consider international law.
The longer you go in Iraq, the more friends you take, the angrier you get, the more resentful you get at the people, the more frustrated you get that you can't find the person who just killed your friends. You know, it's not so much about the mission anymore. It's about, you know, doing what you have to do to make sure you don't have to stand in another formation and listen to Amazing Grace played in bagpipes one more time. There was an understanding that we were going to do what it took to bring everyone else home.
After 5 years of lengthy and frequent deployments, soldiers are left exhausted and struggling with what's asked of them. Cliff Hicks is a tank driver and 50 caliber machine gunner in the U.S. Army. He participated in the initial invasion of Iraq.
The unit which we relieved in the summer of 2003, which was 3-7 Cavalry of the 3rd Infantry Division, had also been given free fire orders when they first entered Baghdad in the spring of that year. Many of the men in 3-7 told stories of massive civilian casualties, and in some cases, direct orders to inflict such casualties. They claimed, as a matter of fact, that they literally, this is what they said, almost to a man, that they had killed everything and everyone who dared to show themselves, animals, people, anything. And this is what happens when a conventional force, such as the U.S. military, attacks a heavily populated urban area. They put us in a situation, you know, we're not bad people. We were there because we thought it was the right thing to do. We were there because we thought we were going to make things better. We were there because we thought these people wanted us to be there. And then you show up and you realize that there's a whole bunch of people there that want to kill you, And guess what? They look just like the folks who don't want to kill you. So are you going to sort them out and figure it out? The only way to ensure your survival is to make sure that you put them in the dirt before they put you in the dirt.
To do this, soldiers say they can't think of their enemy as human. FSRN's Sarah Olson has more from Washington, D.C.
Mike Totten was in the 716 Military Police Battalion, 101st Airborne. Like a lot of soldiers, he learned how to treat Iraqis by watching his commanding officers.
The language that was used, such as Haji, in Arabic a term of endearment, the military has turned that into a disempowering word. Sergeant Major, in one specific mission brief, said that Haji is an obstacle. Do not let him get in our way. If they drive in front of us, get them out of our way. Drive through them. This language that was used was common practice. It was used as a tool to degrade and dehumanize these people. It gave us permission to separate ourselves from the people of Iraq.
Former Staff Sergeant Camilo Mejia says dehumanizing the enemy is a necessary part of war, but it has consequences.
It's almost impossible to act upon your morality in a situation when you have been fed all this information that these people are out there to kill you. And what you do is you basically remove the humanity from them to make it easier to oppress them, to brutalize them, to beat them. And in doing so, you remove the humanity from yourself because you cannot act as a human being and do all of these things.
Former Sergeant Brian Kessler deployed 3 times with the 2nd Battalion, 6th Marines, Fox Company. He says you learn to dehumanize Iraqis from nearly every facet of military life.
If you're in an office and you say, "Good morning, Staff Sergeant," the common response in the civilian world would be like, "Oh, good morning to you too." But in the Marine Corps, you get kill babies. And that's motivating. That's meant to motivate you and, you know, start off your day with kill babies. And this isn't something that just happens once. The Marine Corps is filled with one-upsmanship. To say the most dehumanizing, the most racist, the most offensive thing, and to enjoy it while you're doing it.
Mike Totten from the 101st Airborne knows this isn't theoretical. His squad was ambushed in November 2003.
I was arm's length away from a man who was shot in the neck and died, fell to the street and died. I had to lift him into my truck with my gunner and tried to medevac him. As a grenade blew up my left front tire and flattened it, I took about 15 minutes to get back to the hospital. At that point, he'd bled to death.
What happened next, Totten says, is not an isolated incident. It happened in the presence of his lieutenant and within earshot of non-commissioned officers. The Iraqi police arrested 6 men, claiming they'd participated in the ambush. Totten was present for their processing.
They were tagged, they were searched, and they were also beaten. Not just by Americans, but by Bulgarian soldiers and by Polish soldiers, by Iraqi policemen, and by me. I grabbed the man by the jaw, and I looked him in the eye, and I slammed his head up against the wall. And I looked him again in the eye and said, "You must have been the one that killed Grilly." And then he fell, I kicked him. An Iraqi policeman, probably the size of the biggest security man here, hit a guy in the side of the head about 6 times, and I thought to myself, I'm looking at him and I laughed. I'm like, "Yeah, these guys are getting what they deserve."
Today, Totten and others like him have become some of the most vocal and compelling voices opposing ongoing occupation.
I am very sorry for my actions, and I can't take back what I did. I ask the forgiveness of the people of Iraq and of my country, and I will not enable this any further.
On the 5th anniversary of the Iraq War, active duty soldiers and recent veterans are resisting ongoing occupation in record numbers. Additionally, many in the military are breaking with the traditional code of silence to share their political views and their experiences, no matter how painful. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Sarah Olson, Washington, D.C.
Iraq Veterans Against the War organized 3 Warrior Writers workshops last year, giving about 20 former service members a forum to share their thoughts, stories, and experiences from their time in Iraq. From Chicago, Zach Badarf and Jessica Popovac introduce us to one Army National Guard soldier who spent more than a year deployed in the Middle East in support of Operation Iraqi Freedom.
My name is Aaron Hughes. I served in the Illinois Army National Guard from 2000 to 2006. I served with the 1244 Transportation Company. I was deployed in OIF from 2003 to 2004. I ran convoy missions in and out of Iraq.
Aaron Hughes was an 88M. He drove 30-foot-long tractor trailers packed with supplies from military bases in Kuwait to locations throughout Iraq. Many of his fellow soldiers didn't make it home, including some in his transportation convoys.
I am who survived, forgive me. 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 I am who survived, don't forgive me. I am who survived, don't forgive me. I am survived, hate me. I am who survived, hate me. I am who survived, hate me, kill me. I am who survived, kill me. I am who. I am who, helped dirt and dust and death. I am who drove through dirt and dust and flesh and guts. I am who kill me. I am who, kill me. I am who, kill me. Not them or you or kid on the road, on death, on guts, on blood, dirt, blood, road, blood, horizon, and I am who? I am who? I am. I am lost and tired and nothing. I am lost, guts, thrown up. I am who survives. Kill me. I am who survived. I am who survived.
When I got home, I had an opportunity. I start looking into groups after not helping the kids in Iraq for so long and actually participating in their, oppression, I guess, or contributing to their pain. I wanted to help, and I got to meet Ahmed through this organization called Global Medical Relief Fund. And what they do is they get requests from children in Iraq and other war-torn countries to get prosthetics here in the United States. And Ahmed was here in the States getting reconstructive eye surgery and face surgery and also a prosthetic arm. And I had the opportunity to spend a few days with him. And this is a poem about him. Ahmed. The children lining the roads of Iraq begging for food filled me with guilt, cynicism, and anger. Yet Ahmed, who has been raped by this war, raped of his youth, raped of his body, raped of his sight, raped of his home, raped of his freedom, has no cynicism in his thoughts. He gives love and trust without fear. He grabs my hand and yells, run, run, please, please run. We're getting told things all the time through media, through advertisement, and we have a very set way of taking in information. And when you find creative ways to challenge that, to jar that up, to create new spaces for discussion, I think that's really what the project's doing. It's saying, here's a space that we're challenging the daily conventions and our cultural conventions that's been shutting down the voices of veterans.
For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Zach Badworf with Jessica Popovac in Chicago.
You've been listening to Free Speech Radio News on this fifth anniversary of the start of the Iraq War. From Pacifica Station, KPFK in LA, I'm Aura Bogado.